source of inspiration. So if you do want a few quick hits of inspiration, give us a go over to Photo Jojo and check out their link for that photographic dictionary. I'll include a link to that in the show notes as well. Now, there is a lot more, of course, going around the industry and around the web. I didn't want to give just four in this week's episode because we've got a lot to cover. Coming up in the next few segments, the feature artist for this week, I'm going to be taking a look at Peggy Dyer, a local photographer from right here in Boulder, Colorado. So I'm going to want to give her a little airtime on the show. She's got really great projects she's working on. I'm going to encourage everyone to stop over to her site and take a gander for yourself. You're going to see pictures of yours truly up there in short order. And last but not least, the third segment will be the Helvetica movie that came out just about a year ago. Actually, 2007, I think, is one of those movies. Had some time to sit down and watch it. Learned quite a bit about topography, have a newfound appreciation for it, and the nuances to look for when you are looking at fonts and topography, and where you use certain ones and how to use them, and the impact they can have on things. And all this may not sound like it's related to topography, and that is how you frame your prints, how you title your prints, how you present them in shows, things of that nature. So if you don't want to stick around for that last segment on the movie Helvetica, very good movie, and I'm going to give some more details on that in that segment. That's all the fun things out with listener questions and road tips, so don't go away. Welcome back. In this segment, our feature artist for the week is Peggy Byers. She is our first feature artist, and she is a local photographer from Boulder, Colorado. She's been shooting for quite a while. I think she said she started in 1993 doing photography for a living, and she really is quite an accomplished artist. I caught up with her just as she was starting a new project that is going on, and her project is called 1 Million Faces. She has a website set up at 1millionfaces.org, and it's a pretty ambitious one. She's saying she wants to take 1 million pictures by the end of 2009. And while many of them math numbers probably don't jive very easily, because you have to take like 3,000 pictures a day, working an 8-hour day. It doesn't really matter about the numbers. It's a really cool idea. She's trying to get people to connect with one another. And she's got the really cool goal of making the last face, or last portrait picture that she takes in 2009, to be that of President Barack Obama. It's a really neat project. It's got some great energy. I got a chance to catch up with her over in Boulder on one of her shoots. She actually had me as one of her subjects, so I believe I'm the first 100 of the 1millionfaces.org project, which is rather flattering. But the biggest part was the really cool part is that she's taking donations for everyone who has a portrait done. And the donations are going towards charities. And she's going to be taking her project across the country to help raise money for local charities all across the country. And then she's posting your portraits to a Flickr account that she has set up, where you can actually download copies of your photos that were taken of you to use for your own personal use. It's 1millionfaces.org. That is the website for the project. I'll put a link to that in the show notes. And if you want to catch up with Peggy Dyer as a professional photographer, she has her own dedicated website as well at peggydyer.com. And you will also want to check out the link to her Flickr site where she's posting the pictures, because she really does know how to bring out the best in people when she's taking their pictures. When I met up with her, like I said, she was on a photo shoot, and she just really had such a positive energy, such a really positive vibe, and a great way of looking at things, and the inspiration for the project was just pure genius, something I'd never thought of before. I've never really made these kinds of associations before, and seeing how she makes these associations so quickly and so easily, and just being around her was really inspirational in and of itself. Taking up this opportunity that I had to meet with Peggy and share it with the rest of the photography community. Once again, the website is 1millionfaces.org. She's a very talented photographer. It's a wonderful, fantastic, genius, creative idea that she's undertaking here. Really ambitious undertaking as well. And she's got an assistant that is helping her with the process. It's really, I did a little bit of assistance myself during the interview that I did with her on Saturday.
action, and really didn't get across the energy and the dynamics that she had going on in her photo shoots. It was really cool, and I wanted to really sit down and capture that with her. So we're going to meet up again later on this week, and I would encourage you to stop by the blog either towards the tail end of this week or beginning of next week to see the actual video interview that I'm going to put together with her, so that people can get a better idea of who she is, what she's about, what the project is about, and where she's going to be taking it from here when she goes on the road. But if you get a chance before the weekend, her website is onelinefacing.org for the project. And the personal website for Peggy is over at peggydyer.com, and I'll also put a link to her Twitter page on the blog show notes as well. So just stop over at kennenblogger.com so you get those show notes. Coming up next, I'm going to share with you my most unusual source of inspiration. This was a movie I saw just recently called Helvetica. It's all about typography and font and the impact that one particular font has had on cultures pretty much across the globe over the last 50 years, called, believe it or not, Helvetica. So you're going to want to stick around and get the inside scoop on that. Some really good, useful, beneficial, kind of eye-opening information is available in there. And when we come back, we'll also take care of our listener questions on our road tip of the week. So stick around, and I'll be right back. Welcome back to the Learning Digital Photography Podcast. In this segment, I'm going to be taking a look at a rather unusual source of inspiration I had recently. This came from a movie called Helvetica. This had been getting a little bit of attention around the blogosphere in photography, primarily because we do use Skype each and every day, and we may not be aware of it. And watching this movie really brought my senses more in tune to the effect and the impact that Skype choices on whatever message it is you're trying to express. And since photography is always about expressing a message or expressing a particular vision, when we incorporate typography into our photography, into our graphic arts, that can have an impact as well. So when you title your work, for example, that can have an impact on the overall feel and emotion associated with that image, how you promote your work, whether it's on the web, whether it's via print. The typography that you choose, the colors, the spacing, the kerning, the font choices that you make, all of them have a really huge impact. And watching this movie really made me realize how huge of an impact it can have. And the Helvetica font, I didn't even know this, I didn't know a lot about this movie until after I watched it, but the Helvetica font is actually characterized by curvature in curved areas and in straight lines across other areas. And the place that I see it most pronounced is in the lowercase A and in the lowercase E. And if you look at the lowercase A, the right-hand vertical line has a horizontal cut point on top and a horizontal cut point on the bottom. And you know, with the curvature of the A, it really defines the space for that A rather distinctly and uniquely. Also, in the lowercase e, it goes straight across horizontally in the middle, and then loops around and it comes back up, and there's another horizontal cut line on the under curvature of the e. So it's really interesting to see how this font evolved, and it shows people working on creating fonts. And it was rather inspirational because I was thinking, hey, that would be really cool to actually go out and design a font. And I've never really given that much thought before, but when you look at fonts and the characteristics they have, you see some that are curved, some that are more straight, some that combine elements of both, some that have a native wide kerning where there's a lot of space between each letter. The thickness of the letters can have an impact on their message. And the Helvetica font, I found out, was actually a move towards simplicity. The previous era had been predominated by tower size and the very graphic, loopy, scrolly fonts that were actually kind of confusing, or I shouldn't say confusing, but more of a dense and romantic culture. And the Helvetica font was actually very much a huge impact on the future of advertising, on the future. see what they're talking about. They talk about the simplicity of the font and the almost utilitarian nature of the font. And it really is utilitarian when you start seeing these comparisons being made side by side. And the most amazing thing about this font is how predominant its use has been. If you look at street signs or government buildings or anything municipal, because it's easy to read, because it's got very distinct lines and definition and space, and the thickness of the lines are very simple, so it's very easy to read. This, you can see how it would be used in things like governance, bureaucracies, utilitarian things, which is why it was probably defined as a utilitarian font. And also, the movie also is very useful because it can help you understand the differences between serif and sans serif. I didn't understand it before. It's actually got me quite excited about typography. I'm eager to actually give it a whirl with trying to create a font of my own. I keep going to come up with one. But it's always fun to explore new things, and this definitely is a source of inspiration in exploring new patterns that previously had not been explored. And I would encourage others that are listening to this podcast or are readers of it blog to check this movie out. I was able to watch it on Netflix, and I have it played now on Netflix. You can rent it from Netflix, you can rent it from Best Buy, or not Best Buy, the video store, Blockbuster Video. You can go to local video stores, you can buy the video. It's only like $10.99. You can probably find it in whatever local venue you have available to you. But the movie's outside of Helvetica. It just came out in 2007, so it's a little more than a year old, but it really was an eye-opening video. It's more of a historical video than an entertainment type video. So if you like things like the History Channel, Discovery Channel, A&E, National Geographic, it's definitely a documentary along those lines. So it's very informative, very educational. They talk about how it was created, the precursors to Helvetica, the Romantic era, the post-Romantic era, that are all tied into Helvetica's views and the movement away from Helvetica and the post-Romantic era, or the post-modern era, I should say, not Romantic, the modern era. Helvetica was defined by the modern era, was part of the modern era of graphic design. And you can see its evidence, and it's, I think they use the term ubiquitous nature inside the movie, very ubiquitous, it's common, it's everywhere. Everyone has used it at some point. When you look at some of the companies that have incorporated Helvetica fonts in their logos, it really is just amazing how predominant and how dominant actually this font has become. Really, really worth watching the movie. It's only about an hour and 20 minutes. You can stream it over the internet if you have Netflix or if another movie service. I'm sure it's probably available through lots of venues. Really cool, a very educational, interesting, and believe it or not, gripping, for lack of a better word, type of movie. And it made me start thinking about fonts in a very different way, about the impact that a font and typography can have on whatever message it is that you want to send. And as artists, I think we can all appreciate that. So if you are so inclined in exploring new avenues, new sources of inspiration, and in getting your message out there as effectively as possible, Helvetica the movie is a very good resource to look into. Like I said, it's only about an hour and 20 minutes. Average length of most podcasts these days is an hour, so it really is not that much time when you look at the grand scheme of things, especially when it can be as eye-opening as this was for me. So I would encourage you to look at that movie when you have the time to do so. I'll be back right after this with our listener questions and our final road tip for the week. Welcome back for our final segment this week on Lighting Photography. Our first question comes to us from William right here in Colorado, and he writes in to ask, how do you tell whether or not a scene or an image is a good candidate for HDR photography? Well, thank you very much for the question. And for those of you who don't know, HDR stands for High Dynamic Range. And this procedure does is it will take multiple exposures of the same image, and you usually use on a tripod so the camera won't move. But you take multiple exposures and you stamp them or you blend them together, you combine them the shadow detail and all of the highlight detail across a much wider range than what you would normally see inside your camera settings when you look at your histogram. Usually when you look at your histogram in camera, you'll start bumping up against the exposure range, because usually you can only expose for a range of plus or minus one stop in camera for any single image. So if you want to express an image that has more than one stop of light available, then you need to composite the images together, and that's called high dynamic range or HDR photography. So you're bracketing your pictures, you're getting them set up, and I know I'm using a lot of semantics here, but hopefully one will understand those. You want to look for scenes that include areas where there's a lot of shadow and also where there's a lot of light. So you're going to have to kind of be careful in how you define it. It's not hard science, it's more of a soft science. You have to kind of have an idea of what it is you're looking for. I tried, for example, in my last photo shoot out in Boulder, Colorado, over in one of the state parks there that I talked about, where I did some high dynamic range photography, and I said, actually, I'm going to share some on the blog. Turned out the shots that I captured weren't as good candidates for HDR as I had originally thought. So it's not always easy. You can't always just know, oh, this image is a good candidate for HDR. You really have to take the time, look at your images, look at whether or not there's highlight detail and shadow detail inside the area of composition that you want to capture. And if you do see both, then yes, it would be a good candidate for HDR. Hopefully that answers your question, Will. Thank you very much for writing in. Our next question comes to us from Wendy. Wendy writes in from Edmonton, Alberta. So that's up in Canada, and that means Ken and Robert and Dream Digital Photography have gone international. Thank you very much for writing in. Wendy writes in to ask, I'm shooting wide open. My ISO is cranked. I'm getting good separation, but I can never seem to hold the camera steady enough for even that fraction of a second to get the subject in focus. What can I do next? Well, thank you, Wendy, for writing in. I do appreciate it. And let me just clarify a couple of terms she's using here. Sounds like she's pretty well up to speed on some of the basics. For some of the other readers, though, some of this terminology can be confusing, which refers to the fact that she's shooting wide open. She's referring to her aperture. So she has her aperture open to its widest setting. This would be a value of 1.2, 1.4, 1.8, or 2.0, or a very low number rather than a high number, because that will open the aperture up that much wider. So she has a pretty wide aperture. She says her ISO is cranked, and that means she has her ISO setting set pretty high. I'm guessing around 800, 1500, maybe even 3200 or 6400, depending on what camera body she has. And then she says she's getting good separation. So when she says she's getting good separation, that tells me that positioning her subject, or herself anyway, so that her subject has a fair amount of distance between itself and the background or the other possibly distracting materials or objects that are in the frame. So when she says she's getting good separation, she's separating her subject from this point of distraction or from the background. And then she rounds out her question by saying, what can I do to hold the camera steady long enough for that fraction of a second? Well, keep in mind, Wendy, when we do composition like this, it really is going to be a function of how close you are to your subject. I was actually on a website just the other day, Digital Proton, David Fleischer's site, I believe, and he actually did a pretty good description of how to shoot in these low-light available light situations where you have your ISO cranked, where you have your aperture set wide open. And one of the things he says is that your focus does have to be down, because you're not going to have a big range for your depth of field when you have a very wide aperture setting. section over on the blog. You can submit questions there as well. We'll take them pretty much any form. And if you write in, you may see your name featured on the next section of listener questions here about learning digital photography. So to wrap up the show, I'm going to take you up with a road tip. And the road tip this week is actually related to pet photography. I am a little very proud of the room, so you know about my dog, Maggie. A lot of pictures of her, and oftentimes because I'm working in low light or I'm having to shoot fast shutters, I will have a flash, whether it's on camera or off camera, and that flash can often produce the green eye effect that we're all so familiar with in the scene. Flash photography used with pets and animals. And the problem with the green eye is that most photo editing applications don't have a green eye reduction. You usually will see red eye reduction. Tools built in the photo editing applications, but you don't have green eye reduction tools built in. And I've got a neat way for you to take care of that. What to do is inside your document, you want to insert an image, you want to create a selection of just the eyes where you've got that green eye thing going on. And when you create that selection, go ahead and copy that up to its own layer. So I know, of course, assuming you're using Photoshop or Photo Elements or thank you very much, everyone, for tuning in. If you do have future requests